This is Between the Covers. I'm Jim Schumach, and welcome. My guest today is novelist, short story writer, screenwriter, and memoirist John Irving. Born in Exeter, New Hampshire, 1942, his memoirs are The Imaginary Girlfriend and My Movie Business. His short story collection is entitled Trying to Save Piggy Sneed. His novels include, but are not limited to, The World According to Garp, The Hotel New Hampshire, The Cider House Rules, A Prayer for Owen Meany, A Widow for 1 Year, and most recently, Last Night in Twisted River, just published by Random House. Welcome to Between the Covers, John.
Thank you.
You were born in the year that John Knowles set his novel A Separate Piece at Exeter. What was it like for you growing up there?
Well, I liked the town. My stepfather taught at Exeter, so I went to the academy as a faculty brat, so-called. And, of course, in those days, we all had to read A Separate Piece as Exeter students. I can't remember whether it was in grade 9 or 10, but it was a book on the required reading list. Years later, when I was living in the Hamptons, I met John Knowles. He was a nice guy, and I told him that story, and he said, "Oh, I hate it that I'm required."
You know, I was thinking, and I often think this, that in America we're often required to read The Red Badge of Courage, but your friend Günter Grass has written a book I'd compare and contrast and require, which is Cat and Mouse.
Cat and Mouse is a wonderful novel, and it's a kind of rarity among Grass's strongest novels, I think, because it's a short one. And I think, you know, Grass's best-known work and most interesting work is generally long. But that's a gem of a short novel. And I think it's not always the case that someone who is as powerful in the long novel form as he is can also be effective in the short novel, as effective as that novel is.
I think also of William Styron's A Long March, someone else who's written long works and whose short work was also an important work.
Yes, and William Maxwell's So Long, See You Tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. You never met your biological father. Does that in any way kind of lessen the familial infrastructure that you feel about your family?
It's interesting, you know, as many people who've asked me about not knowing my biological father, it's usually a writing-connected question. No one's asked me about its impact on me as a member of an actual family so much as its impact on me in terms of the various fictional families usually missing a component or two that I have so repeatedly written about. No, I don't think so. I think those things that are closed doors to you as a child, I at least learned to accept it. But I did an interesting thing with the information. In other words, I decided that since no one would talk to me about who this guy, my missing father, was, it was a closed subject, that I decided, therefore, that two things. He must have been a monster, and they were trying to protect me from something. Therefore, if they weren't going to talk about it, I wasn't interested, and I would, you know, just as an act of will, sort of steel myself to any apparent signs of interest in the subject. I think kids do that repeatedly. The door is always closed. Therefore, you find a way to say, true or not, "Oh, I'm not interested in what's behind that door. That couldn't concern me in the least." But of course, it did concern me. If you look at the number of stories I have imagined about a missing father figure or a missing mother figure or a missing anybody figure in a family, it's clear that in my imagination. I thought about it all the time.
You give some nice props to Oregonian Ken Kesey in The Imaginary Girlfriend, saying what a good wrestler he was. And I know that he lost a son who was on a wrestling trip a quarter of a century ago. So that must have been somewhat difficult for him to accept.
I can't imagine. I can't imagine how difficult. I regret that Kesey is one of the writers I regret never meeting. We almost met a couple of times. We wanted to meet. We had several mutual friends in common. But, you know, we lived at opposite ends of the country, and it just never happened. And I was sorry about that. I lobbied for him very hard at the National Wrestling Hall of Fame. I used to say to people there, you know, when he was still alive, I used to say, come on, if you make me a member of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame, you got to make Kesey a member. He was much more successful as a wrestler than I was. He didn't do it as long. Maybe they gave me the longevity award, you know. Maybe they felt sorry for me because I'd lost to so many people, you know. But in Kesey was really good, you know. I never won a major championship at any level of the sport. But I think, you know, there was some evident, I'm guessing, I don't know this, right? I'm guessing that there was some evident distaste in the wrestling community for how publicly Kesey was a druggie, you know, and that's that. I can't imagine why else they didn't put him in the Hall of Fame. He deserves to be there more than some of us do.
Personally speaking, which is more important to you, being in the Wrestling Hall of Fame or winning an Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay for Cider House Rules?
Well, it's an interesting question. they're comparable in one way, in that I don't really deserve the awards for different reasons. It is not on the merits of my wrestling that I'm a member of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame. It's because I did wrestle and for a long time. I was involved in the sport over a number of years and fond of it and dedicated to it. It was only talent I lacked. But I'm in the Hall of Fame because I became famous and successful at something else, and I was a wrestler. Therefore, I've never really felt that I wholeheartedly belong there. And the quality of the writing, not to mention the status of the writer, is at the bottom of the totem pole in the film recognition business. Nobody notices whether your screenplay is any good or not unless every other part of the film is good. If there's a performance that's out of step, if the editor is bad, if the DP is bad, if the music's no good, if the direction is flawed, if anything else is wrong with the film, nobody's ever going to notice that the screenplay was any good. So in order for a writer to win a Best Adapted Screenplay or a Best Original Screenplay Oscar, it has to be a good film in all the other respects. And so I have to say that any writer who wins an Oscar for a screenplay, it only happens because the rest of the film is up to snuff. I know this more assuredly after having won the Oscar, because I then became a member of the Academy and I get to see all the screeners of the films that are in contention for Oscars every year, and I get to vote. But before the screeners show up, the screenplays come in. It's a revelation to see how many good screenplays there are that turn out to be not very good films. And if they turn out to be not very good films, nobody but the people in the writer's branch of the Academy ever read that screenplay. They never know how good it was, right? And in most cases, the films that are any good, they don't happen because the screenplay was bad, right? In other words, if it's a good film, it probably was a good screenplay. But it could have been a very good screenplay, and it might not be a good film.
Well put. Your friends, the late Robertson Davies and Gunter Grass, both wrote trilogies. Davies was working on his fourth trilogy when he died. Gunter Grass's Danzig trilogy is perhaps his best-known work. As an expansive writer that you are, how come you've never attempted a trilogy?
Well, if you consider how many of my characters die, you'd have to realize that in order for me to write a trilogy, I'd have to believe in actual resurrection. Or I'd have to say, well, no, they didn't really die. Because there aren't enough characters left over at the end of most of my novels for there to be a sequel, much less a trilogy. I wouldn't know how to do it. I also think that the model of the form for me was always the 19th century novel. I would rather err on the side of writing a long, lavishly detailed novel than compartmentalizing novels into either a sequel or a trilogy form. I think my novels demand enough of readers individually to not want to tax my readers further with the burden or possible burden of a trilogy. Though I certainly, especially in Robertson Davies' case, I think that format was wonderful and wonderfully well executed in his hands. Even though Fifth Business, the first novel of the Deptford trilogy, is my favorite of his novels, and I'm sure I'm not alone in that opinion, I think the Salterton trilogy is the best trilogy. Those three comic novels, while none of them has the sting, the punch of Fifth Business, the three novels together are just, there's a kind of orchestral comic perfection to them. It's a terrific piece of work, that Salterton trilogy.
I have some Canadian friends who grew up in logging camps, and after the logging was through, they bulldozed down the camps, and here are these people now who can point to no hometown.
You can look at northern New Hampshire and some of those logging camps in northern New England, only tumbled down, bulldozed, or burned down evidence remains. My uncle was in the logging business in the northern part of New Hampshire. My cousins are still in the business. I went with my cousin Byards one winter back into the upper Androscoggin area of Coos County looking for a couple of former logging camps. And you could find them on the evidence of the old Lombard steam log haulers. Some of the later models were gasoline engine Lombards, but the tracks had all been eaten. The ski runners, the sled runners were all gone. The ones that were pulled by horses, of course, the horses were no longer there. They'll never get them out. They're indestructible. They're as big as a 50-ton locomotive. And it's like coming upon the skeleton of a dinosaur. Because the river drives are gone. The river drives are over. A way of life is gone. I remember seeing those logs in the rivers.
Me too.
When I was a teenager in northern New England. They stopped running logs in Vermont and New Hampshire quite some time before they stopped in Maine. I think the last log drive in the state of Maine was 1976 down the Kennebec River. But it of course, it's all been gone for some time.
Your new novel, Last Night in Twisted River, takes place in a logging town. Wonder if you'd give us a sense of the overall story you tell.
This novel has been in my mind, in the back of my mind in any case, for more than 20 years. No novel I've written has ever been in my mind so long before I even began it. As long as 20 years ago, I already knew the kind of rudimentary story. There was a cook. He had a pre-teenage son. He worked either in a logging camp or a fishing village or one of those lobstering towns close to the Maritimes. I hadn't yet determined on the logging camp, but the logging camp was there as a possible location from the beginning. It mattered that it was northern New England. It mattered that it be close to the Canadian border for reasons obvious to the story. And it mattered that it be a frontier kind of place with a very primitive justice system. One law, a bad cop. That was essential to the story. There was, as long ago as 20 years, always an act of violence, a mistake, but a violent act nonetheless, that makes this cook and his young son fugitives. It puts them on the run, and they would be running for 50 years. And I even knew why the cook had a 12-year-old son, because I wanted that boy, at the end of my novel, to have become a writer. In fact, I wanted everything about his life to have in some way contributed to his imagination, to the degree that this guy, this boy now grown up to be a writer, he's always more comfortable in his imagination than he ever will be in his own skin, than he ever will be in his so-called personal life, which is a very unhappy personal life. So that as fulfilled as he is in his imagination, he becomes increasingly reclusive and lonely in his actual life. But, you know, knowing all that somehow wasn't enough for me to be able to begin the book, because I'd never begin writing a novel until I've plotted it out. And I don't begin the process of plotting a novel until I know not only what the end of the story is, not only what happens at the end of the story, but until I've written the last sentence. And in 12 novels, not even the punctuation of those last sentences has ever changed. When I get that last sentence, I then make a map, a kind of roadmap of the action of the story. I kind of make my way backwards to where the book might best begin. And that journey from the last sentence, which I get first, to the first sentence, which I get last, it usually takes about a year just to make the plot of the action of the novel. Sometimes 18 months. It has taken that long. In this book's case, that last sentence just eluded me for a long time. And I began other books that had been on my mind for not nearly as long as this one. But those last sentences presented themselves to me sooner.
Would you give us a reading now from Last Night in Twisted River? And for those of you who have just joined us, this is Jim Schumach with Between the Covers. My guest today, novelist John Irving, reading from his latest work.
The process of Danny and his dad being admitted to Canada as new citizens was a slow one. Danny had applied as self-employed. The immigration lawyer representing him had categorized the writer as someone who participates at a world-class level in cultural activities. Danny made enough money to support himself and his father. They'd both passed the medical exam. While they were living in Toronto on visitors' visas, it had been necessary for them to cross the border every 6 months to have their visas validated. Also, they'd had to apply for Canadian citizenship at a Canadian consulate in the United States. Buffalo was the closest American city to Toronto. An assistant to the Minister of Immigration and Citizenship had discouraged them from a so-called fast-track application. In their case, what was the hurry? The famous writer wasn't rushing to change countries, was he? The immigration lawyer had forewarned Danny that Canadians were a little suspicious of success. They tended to punish it, not reward it. In fact, to escape undue attention, the cook and his son had made the slowest possible progress in their application for Canadian citizenship. The process had taken four, almost 5 years. But now, with the Florida fiasco, there'd been comments in the Canadian media about the writer Danny Angel's defection, his giving up on the United States when he did, more than a decade ago, made the author appear prescient, or so the Toronto Globe and Mail had said. It didn't help that the film, adapted from East of Bangor, had released in theaters only recently in 1999, and the movie had won a couple of Academy Awards in 2000. Early in the new year, 2001, a joint session of Congress would meet to certify the electoral vote in the states. Now that there was going to be a U.S. president who opposed abortion rights, it came as no surprise to Danny and his dad that the writer's liberal abortion politics were back in the news. And writers were more in the news in Canada than in the United States, not only for what they wrote, but for what they said and did. Danny was still sensitive to what he read about himself in the American media, where he was frequently labeled anti-American, both for his writing and because of his expatriation to Toronto. In other parts of the world, without fail in Europe and in Canada, the author's alleged anti-Americanism was viewed as a good thing. It was written that the expatriate writer vilified life in the United States, that is, in his novels. It had also been reported that the American-born author had moved to Toronto to make a statement. Despite Danny Angel's commercial success, he had accepted the fact that his Canadian taxes were higher than what he'd paid in the States. But as a novelist, Danny was increasingly uncomfortable when he was condemned or praised for his perceived anti-American politics. Naturally, he couldn't say, most of all not to the press, why he had really moved to Canada. What Danny did say was that only two of his seven published novels could fairly be described as political. He was aware that he sounded defensive in saying this, but it was notably true. Danny's fourth book, The Kennedy Fathers, was a Vietnam novel. It was read as a virtual protest of that war. The sixth, East of Bangor, was a didactic novel, in the view of some critics, an abortion rights polemic. But what was political about the other five books? Dysfunctional families, damaging sexual experiences, various losses of innocence, all leading to regret. These stories were small domestic tragedies, none of them condemnations of society or government. In Danny Angel's novels, the villain, if there was one, was more often human nature than the United States. Danny had never been any kind of activist. All writers are outsiders, Danny Angel had once said. I moved to Toronto because I like being an outsider. But no one believed him. Besides, it was a better story that the world-famous author had rejected the United States. Danny thought that his move to Canada had been sensationalized in the press. The presumed politics of their entirely personal decision magnified out of proportion. Yet what bothered the novelist more was that his novels had been trivialized. Danny Angel's fiction had been ransacked for every conceivably autobiographical scrap. His novels had been dissected and overanalyzed for whatever could be construed as the virtual memoirs hidden inside them. But what did Danny expect? In the media, real life was more important than fiction. those elements of a novel that were at least based on personal experience were of more interest to the general public than those pieces of the novel writing process that were merely made up. In any work of fiction, weren't those things that had really happened to the writer, or perhaps to someone the writer had intimately known, more authentic, more verifiably true than anything that anyone could imagine? This was a common belief, even though a fiction writer's job was imagining truly a whole story. As Danny had subversively said whenever he was given the opportunity to defend the fiction in fiction writing, because real-life stories were never whole, never complete in the ways that novels could be.
Thanks for reading that, John. For Between the Covers, this is Jim Schumach. My guest today, novelist John Irving. His most recent work, Last Night in Twisted River, has just been published by Random House. It's wonderful to have met you, John. Thanks so much for dropping by this morning.
Thank you.